everyone, welcome. This is Iowa City Equity and Human Rights's final lens series offering of 2024. We're delighted to have author Deirdre Mask with us here to discuss her book, The Address Book: What Street Addresses Reveal About Identity, Race, Wealth, and Power. Ms. Mask is a graduate of both Harvard College and Harvard Law School. Originally from North Carolina, she joins us today from her home in London, and she will speak first about the book and then take questions. So I encourage everyone to enter your questions in the question box as they occur to you, and we will try to get to all of them. The program is being recorded. It will be available on City Channel 4 in about a week. So welcome, Ms. Mask. Take it away.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a delight to be here. I was telling Kristen that when I was writing a book about street addresses, I thought nobody would feel as passionately about street addresses as me. So it's always lovely when people are interested in the topic. I'm just going to give a 10-minute overview or so of the book, and I'm going to tell you how it started out, which is really with procrastination, which is that I was living in Ireland at the time. I live in London now, and my husband's from Ireland. And I was sending a letter from to my dad in North Carolina. And I just had this sort of procrastination moment. You know, when I pay for the stamp in Ireland, how does the money somehow make it to the United States Postal Service to deliver it? Anyway, this led me to this amazing website, which I encourage you all to go to, which is the website of the Universal Postal Union, which is the second oldest UN organization. And it has a name that sounds so boring, I think on purpose to conceal how incredibly interesting what they do is. And when I was on this website, I came across this interesting fact, which is that millions of people around the world, perhaps even billion people around the world, don't have street addresses. And I thought, oh, well, that's kind of quirky. Like, what does that mean you don't have a street address? I thought it was sort of an interesting fact. But the more I read about it, the more I learned how hugely important it is to have a street address. Because without a street address, you can't do things like bank, you can't get credit, identity cards are difficult to get, much less a passport. It can be difficult to register your children for school. There's all sorts of reasons why people need addresses. And it's one of the reasons why the World Bank has called street addressing one of the cheapest ways to help lift people out of poverty. So again, I just thought this was kind of an interesting bit of procrastination. But then I learned that there were parts of my own country, the United States, that also didn't have street addresses. And this was something I needed to see. So my next trip home, I ended up borrowing my dad's car and driving from North Carolina to West Virginia to write a story for the Atlantic magazine about addresslessness in West Virginia. And what I found there sort of sparked the whole book. Because what happened was there were people there who lived, they were in rural areas. This is the county I was in, I believe, is the second poorest county in America. We're talking about the Appalachian Mountains. And people would address in these unusual ways. They would navigate their places in these unusual ways that required you to know the places. Like there was a dumpster shaped like a cow, or the old sewing factory, or the old radio station. A lot of things were old because a lot of people were leaving. It was sort of a, because there weren't very many economic opportunities there. Anyway, there was a push to give street addresses there because of 911, because there had been people who had died because it was really hard to find people. And one ambulance driver I talked to said he would use the sirens to sort of triangulate to try to figure out where people were. Like, you know, he'd turn them on and say, "Am I getting closer? Am I, colder? Am I getting hotter?" to try to figure it out. And that's no way for an emergency. But what really sparked the book was that there's a pop certain group of people in West Virginia who really didn't want addresses. And I was curious about them. And there were addressers would tell stories of being met at their door with machetes or on four-wheelers because people didn't want addresses. And I was like, And you talk to people and they would say, "Oh, you know, these people are really ignorant. They're just country people. They don't understand what an address is." But actually, I learned that they were actually sort of the cleverer people that I was thinking of. They were actually quite smart and on it. Because one of the themes of the book is that street addresses are not just for you to get an ambulance at your door or to get post through your mailbox or, you know, to get the Amazon packages piling up at your door. They're really also for the state to be able to find and track us because the state uses them to tax, to police us, to make sure kids go to school, public health. Now, whether this is good or bad depends on your view of the state. I tend to think the state is a good thing, but it's not wrong to think about what addresses mean and how they do influence your life and influence the relationship of the state in your life. So the book sort of proceeds from there. So I spent a lot of time in Calcutta. It's now called Kolkata in India, and places the government calls slums, where I was following a team that was addressing these slums because they didn't also have addresses. And they wanted addresses for all the same reasons that I described: banking, credit, secure mail, packages, all of those good reasons. But one thing I really learned there was the identity nature of an address. And the way that I described this is, if you lost your wallet tomorrow, you would probably be able to tell the police that you had $60 in there, but you probably wouldn't even include the change, right? It'd be like, if they were, was there 10 cents or 60 cents? I don't really know. But when we don't address people, we're kind of treating them like that change, right? To be counted is to be measured and to be known. And I really saw that very dramatically in India. And I can relate to that about what that would feel like. In fact, one of the very first people I interviewed for the book was actually a South African voting official. And he was black and had lived in a township and that didn't have addresses, whereas, the areas of the cities, especially the white areas, would have street addresses. And he said he had a cousin who had a street address and it was very glamorous. He thought it was very glamorous and that people in his village would put up a number on their door. And it sounds silly, but that makes so much sense to me, that to be counted and to be seen as somebody worthy of being found is important. So I saw lots of addresslessness. There's also a chapter on Haiti that shows how, when Haiti had an outbreak of cholera after the terrible earthquake in 2010, it was more difficult for epidemiologists to track the cholera than it had been in 1850s Victorian London, because 1850s Victorian London had street addresses that made it easy to pinpoint where everybody lived and to track where the disease was coming from and how it was spreading. Whereas Haiti, even then, was very poorly, badly addressed in many areas, not addressed at all. But it's not just about addresslessness. The book's also about sort of the history of our street addresses. How did we get these? There's a chapter on London, which is where I live, which has, I think, very interesting street names because they're very, very old, and they tended to operate almost as maps or directories when before there was a computer where you could look things up. So there are streets in the city of London like Milk Street or Hog Lane, because that's where you'd find your milk, or Ironmonger's, road, where you'd go and get your, frying pans and the like, or whatever. I love that my publisher in the UK, their street name is Cloth Fair. I mean, Cloth Fair, that's just lovely. But presumably that was where you could go for cloth, so that they sort of operated that way. And house numbers is also a really interesting story. So I tell that story through the Empress Maria Theresa. She was the Empress of the Habsburg Empire. She's well known for having had 16 children, one of whom was Marie Antoinette. And she decided to give house numbers to people in her empire to be able to find them, right? To be able to find, especially men, for the many wars that she was often entangled in. And people, as they did in West Virginia, they protested. They did not want them because they knew what was going to happen, right? That once they were no longer anonymous to the state, and once there was a number on the door, and this was also connected with this kind of census taking, that they could be found, and they didn't want that. Now, very soon, they learned to love them, as we all have, and they forgot this. But the fact that there were people brought before court for defiling their house numbers tells you something. So we have that. We have the history of how street names came about, and we also have the political nature of street addresses. So street addresses are about power, and that which is really the most important word in the subtitle of the book. They're really about power. And what does that mean exactly? Well, the people who write history also write the street names. That's something I've always said. So in World War II, before World War II, for example, in Nazi Germany, every town and city would have had a street called Adolf Hitler Strasse, right? This is a way of imprinting your power on the landscape. And it's amazing propaganda because you have to use it, you have to say it, you have to see the signs. And it's one of the reasons why, when the Allies came into war-torn Germany, I mean, where there was crisis after crisis, that one of the very first things they did was take down the Adolf Hitler street names and the Nazi street names, and because it was just untenable to have a new government with those signs still up. And there's some, you can, if you Google it, there's some very iconic pictures of an American GI taking down Adolf Hitler Strasse, and it was an important image. But this also plays out in other ways as well. There's a places in Eastern Europe, for example, that where the regime has changed so many times that have had six street names or so, in a century. And also interestingly, I was having dinner with a friend here from Ukraine, who was telling me about how the street names had changed in her own city since the Russians had arrived. So this is something that's still going on, and it's still a way that we imprint our power and our values on the streets. And this is why it becomes contentious in times of issues like race. So in the book, I watch this sort of war unfold in Hollywood, Florida, over whether the names of Confederate generals should be street names. These were names that were actually put in black neighborhoods on purpose, really, as a threat. And how that and how people talked about that and thought about that and what ultimately happened there. There's also a chapter on streets named after Martin Luther King Jr., who people don't debate in general that it's a good thing to name them after Martin Luther King, but people debate what the streets mean that are named after him. So there's a classic, a sort of iconic Chris Rock joke where he says, something like, if you find yourself lost on MLK Street, what do? You should run, right? And the book explores why that joke, when it was written, was funny, because or was at least seen as funny, because it sort of highlighted how MLK streets have become sort of shorthand for a kind of urban decline. And then the chapter really goes into this issue and whether it is in fact true. We also talk about how power looks on the streetscape. So, and this is through about how Americans in particular, at least at one point, preferred grids and straight lines and numbered streets. And I looked up in Iowa the most popular street names, which are Second Street, First Street, Third Street, and Fourth Street. So that tells you something. Second Street's probably the most popular because most First Streets are actually Main Street, which is definitely the most popular. So I think these are after Main Street. But this is very, very different in Europe, where there are virtually no numbered streets, tiny pockets of places, but virtually no numbered streets. And in fact, in some places, they're banned. And why is that? Because America saw itself as something very different from Europe, not commemorating kings and queens and aristocrats. We were going to have straight lines. We're going to be rational. But funny enough, today, people are much more likely to name streets after people than to number them. The book also just briefly discusses a sort of a reverse side of being addressless, which is if you're unhoused and you have no home, how do you get a street address and why it's important? And so there's a researcher who surveyed people who didn't have homes, and what they needed, of course, was somewhere to live, but they also needed an address so that they could pass as somebody who wasn't unhoused. So they would, and this is because employers often ask for your street address, and if you don't have one, then they assume they make assumptions about you that mean you don't get a job. And employers freely admit that this is a kind of discrimination that they have practiced in the past. And so, weirdly, in order to get to a state where you are housed, you have to pretend that you are, and an address helps you to do that. So it talks about the problem and also some potential solutions. The final chapter and the last thing that I'll talk about is the role of technology. So even in the early days of writing this book, people would say, oh, why does this matter? Because we have all these great GPS technology and they're always improving it. So you have companies like Google, or there's another company called What3Words that are really great at like using very rational techniques to find you without this weird street names and numbering, and chronicle this in the book. But there was something about it that really bothered me. I really did not want our streetscape to be replaced, with these numbers or these sort of meaningless words. And I was talking to a street naming expert, and his quote will always stick in my mind. I sort of told him this problem, like, why do I care so much? And he said, well, we won't talk about Karl Marx, but we will talk about Karl Marx Street. And that really summed up for me why it matters. Because these street name debates are times and places where we as communities have to decide what matters to us and what doesn't matter. And we have to engage in big issues on a local level. And I think we should keep doing that sort of community work of deciding what matters to us. So I'm going to leave it there, which I think is about 10 minutes, hopefully. But I'm happy to talk about any of this more in depth or answer any other questions. I could talk about street addresses all day, as is probably obvious.
Would you like me to read questions, or would you
Yes,
like me to...
that would be great. Yeah, if you don't mind.
Okay, our first question is thank you for your fascinating book, Deirdre. Can
Oh,
you
thank you.
offer any advice to me about how best to start researching the history of street naming in a specific neighborhood? I'm writing about my childhood subdivision created in the early 1960s, and I would love to learn more about how they chose the names of our streets. Montego Drive, Darien Drive, Tulane Avenue, etc. How would you advise me to start researching how and why these names were chosen?
That's such a great question. It really depends on your community. Most times, when I was always looking for things, I'd start with the local library, not necessarily the bigger library, because often the local library will have the maps, the old maps. And so often you can see whether street names changed or how the land use changed around that time. So there's, for example, where I live, where I'm from in North Carolina, there's a street called Turkey Farm Lane. And I was like, what is this? Like, it was in the middle of nowhere, you know, it was in the, not in the middle of nowhere, it was like in the middle of the suburb subdivision. And of course, when you get the local library map, you see there was an absolutely massive turkey farm there. And so the street name remained, but you didn't know. So you may find through those local records or local directories. So often streets are named after people, for example, who were landowners in the area. So you may find through those local directories and those local maps, you may be able to make some conclusions from the names of the people. There's often kind of historical societies as well. So I was doing some similar research where my dad grew up, and there was a local historical society that was able to tell me ideas, and even locals that you meet on Facebook or whatever would sometimes have ideas. But really, I'd start with sort of the local library. That would be my first shout.
Okay, another question is, I'm interested in more about the changing of street names in New York. The duplicating of street names, does this happen in other cities and towns?
You know, I'm not sure. So I don't know if this is from someone who's read the book, but there's a chapter on Manhattan I didn't talk about, which is fascinating because, as far as I know, it's still happening. At least it was still happening by the time this book was published. Something called vanity street naming, where you could pay the city at the time it was $11,000, so like not even that much, for their approval to name a to name their building or their property. With a street name that wasn't even its actual street name. It's so crazy. So you could have your building's not on Park Avenue, but you could have a Park Avenue address, even though, I mean, it's like the opposite of rationality because it makes you seem fancier. And what this would cause was like total chaos, right? And so they're much less likely to do it now. But there was a time, especially when New York was struggling and trying to court developers, they did this all the time. So you do get this kind of maze of street names that still exist around New York. I don't know if there are any other places that do it. I know Chicago used to do it. But there was a terrible, it's in the book, there was a terrible fire at some point where the somebody died in this fire, and this was attributed in part to the fact that the address was a vanity street name. I've never heard of anyone in Europe doing it, but I wouldn't put it past them because I think it's just an attractive way of luring developers and then later buyers to it. But it's, yeah, I think it's insane.
Did you have any feelings about the street that you grew up on?
Oh, that's a really lovely question. I did, because weirdly enough, I am one of the people who didn't really have a street address growing up. Because when I was growing up on the street, it was seven wait route seven Route 7 Box 663A. So a lot of people will have rural street addresses. I don't know if this is something Iowa still has on some level. I'd be curious to see if anybody had had an experience like that. So yeah, so just so to some extent, I do remember actually getting our street address, and the road always had a name, which was Old Lystra Road. And interesting, back to the first question, I still don't actually really know why it was called Old Lystra Road, but it means something to me partly because I very much remember when we got our number and our street name, and we still call that house by the street name. I don't know if anybody else does this. But when we're talking about the house I grew up in, we talk about Old Lystra. So it becomes sort of tied up in your mind with all these memories.
How do street address and/or zip codes play into healthcare data collection and insurance coverage?
Yeah. So this is an interesting topic because it happens a lot that addresses and zip codes in particular are used for things like, like insurance coverage. So this would come up, for example, in places that had on the one hand, had places that were very close together. So maybe they share the same zip code, but they have very different insurance profiles. So, for example, they, the classic place, if anybody knows Palo Alto, is that there's East Palo Alto and there's Palo Alto. And Palo Alto, as far as I understand, would be, quite well to do. East Palo Alto, much less so. But they would share parts of it, shared the same zip code. And so what would happen was that people were getting quotes based on the zip code for East Palo Alto, that people were very angry about this because they would get these sky high insurance quotes that were related to this neighborhood they didn't live in, and they were actually petitioning, which I thought was amazing, petitioning for a new zip code that would reflect their own community, so they didn't get high insurance rates. And there's an amazing website. I think it's attached to. I'll have to find it and send it out. That actually will show you different zip codes for marketers and what they're like. So one marketer will be like, young upward mobile professionals is one, and one's like, retired community. This is their postcode, and one will be, middle-aged, Republican, whatever. There'll be all sorts of descriptions so that marketers can actually target people based on this. So actually, yeah, addresses are hugely important for all of those things that you described.
Do you have any insight into why address numbers in the US used to go up by one per house, and now they go up by seemingly random numbers for houses that are side by side?
I know. I find this really interesting as well. And one thing I find really interesting as well coming back home is how high the numbers go. So, I remember going to a friend's house and her number was like 11601. It sounded like a Walmart, as some people was, it's like, there's different rational ways for people to give house numbers to. And the way it works is often based on some level of space. And I guess the idea is that often there's spaces in between houses that in theory could, one day get a new number. There may be another home. So even though it seems like it should go one by one, I think they actually are quite rationally anticipating that that street may not always look like that street, and that, house properties may be subdivided, or new homes may be built, or others raised and built again, and they'll be able to sort of rationally fit everything in. But yeah, it does seem very random. I agree. And it's not really like that here in London. In London, it's pretty rational, just because it's been done a lot. It's pretty not that rational. It really does go up by one, just because that's just the way it's always been.
Ah, we have a question from a former student of yours.
Ah, lovely.
Yes, it is more of a craft question. As a
Ah.
person who is both a practicing writer and an instructor of writing,
Yeah.
in what ways does each inform the other? How
Oh,
has being a writer affected your approach to the teaching of writing? How has teaching informed your own writing style or practice?
oh my gosh. I mean, dramatically so. I'm a much better writer for that's a really kind question. I'm a much better writer for teaching, because when you're in terms of your writing, I remember when I first started doing this, I had been a big reader of The New Yorker, as I imagine a lot of you guys are, since I was very young. I remember when I got to college, I had a whole subscription through college, and I would read it from cover to cover. And I just thought, you read it so much, you think it's really easy. You're like, I can totally do this. Like, I know the rhythms. And then you start to do it and you realize it's utterly impossible, that what those writers do in The New Yorker every week is just basically a pipe dream. But so what do you have to do? You have to break it down. And the best way of breaking it down really is to teach it. So you read, in order to teach a class, you have to read so much stuff. You have to find so many craft books. You have to think about it. And then when you're also evaluating a piece of work, you also have to say, what's not working here? Oh yeah, this thing lacks a conclusion, or the complexity is missing here, or this part is just boring. And so in teaching, not only do you learn stuff, you learn it systematically, but you're also able to spot and identify things that go wrong. And in the classes that I've taught, it's always peer review, and peers will have these really interesting things to say about a piece that I never thought about, because we're all readers and we're all writers. So they absolutely go hand in hand by me. I've learned so much more from teaching than I have from just than I could have just at my desk. Definitely. Thank you.
Do public health education include addressing as a dimension of curriculums?
Not that I know of. That's a really interesting question. There I can find quite a few articles, and in the book, there's a really interesting school here. It's called the School for the London School for Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, which is kind of interesting. But it's quite a famous school. It was really set up, I think, really for the British colonial. There are all these British colonials in places like India, and there was these places were set up for research for sort of tropical diseases because of that. And in the book, I interview somebody who sees this as a very obvious point that we really need to find addressing. And I do also, I did talk to people, for example, who emphasize the role that it plays even in things like vaccine campaigns. So I talked to one doctor, I think it was quite a serious, important doctor at Harvard, and he was doing this vaccine campaign, and I can't remember what country it was, but it was a country in Africa, and he said he spent half his time addressing because they had to have addresses because there was a schedule for the vaccine, and they had to make sure everybody had the schedule at the right time, but they couldn't identify people without their addresses, right? They couldn't actually log it and keep track of it, so they spent a long time actually addressing this community. And I hear stories about that as well from people who were community health workers, making sure that people who had HIV were taking their medications on time, and the difficulty of doing that without an address. So I'm not sure. That's a great question. I'd be interested for those who work in public health, whether this is something people talk about. But a lot of people sort of assumed when I talked to them that it was something that had to be done.
Is there any effect on street names and how a child grows up, as in how a child's future job can match their given name, like nominative determinism?
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, definitely, I don't know of any actual studies by this, but it makes, I mean, obviously people use things like we were talking about before, like zip codes, in order to track, all sorts of income inequality and issues. Though that's not as much related to the actual names or the actual places. That's just an easy way of fixing people geographically for this data. But sometimes when I do this with like high school classes, I'll ask them to sort of close their eyes and think about the place where they live, and try to map it out themselves and what they think of different parts of town. Now, I can totally do this with my hometown of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, at least frozen in time in my mind from when I was 18. I haven't lived there in quite a long time, so I couldn't do it again. But I absolutely could tell you which streets were sort of the country club streets, which streets were quite rural, which street there was a sort of a hippie area in our town, which street there was a which area was prominently Black neighborhoods, which would be the sort of smaller Hispanic community, which is much larger now. I could tell you so much about people from where they live, or at least I would have thought I could have told you something about them or made some pretty good guesses. So I can't imagine in a way that doesn't affect you in some way as you're growing up and navigating the world. I mean, obviously your first name, which is also something I'm writing about, does that even more. But yeah, there definitely is an influence on how people see you based on your street address.
Did you have any subjects or case studies that you had to leave out of the book?
Oh my gosh, so many. Oh, so many. And there's so many that came out later as well, that I would have loved to have talked about. And of course, now that I say that, I'm totally blanking. I didn't really talk about the Middle East in the book that much, and I would have been really interested to write a lot more about that. The book's now translated into Arabic, which is really cool. And I was talking to someone in Egypt who was saying that in general, there wasn't a history in the Middle East of street names. That just wasn't really, there was no history of it. But you have colonial areas, like the colonial bits of Cairo, that have street names. And so that was one way of marking this area. Israel is another interesting place, and this has been a big issue in Israel. There have been cases about in the Supreme Court, but a lot of people who in Israel came from Europe, and so they sort of brought the tradition of street addresses. So parts of Israel would have street names, and parts would not. And this was a source of contention, for many years. So there are ways in which our experience of street names, our history of street names, and our culture of street names, is really affected all over the world. And again, there are so many people who have written in really interesting stories that I wish I'd had time to include.
And how did you decide which topics to include, which to exclude?
Well, so that's a great question. I mean, in some ways, I was often thinking thematically. Thinking I would have like a question in my mind, like why do we have like numbered streets, right? So that leads you to places like Philadelphia, which is the first place in America that had numbered streets, and it leads you to New York. And so, those stories really match together. There's an unusual pairing in the book between Iran, which about a story of sort of Iranian revolutionaries like changing street names in Iran. But there was sort of a weird juxtaposition with Northern Ireland, which is where my husband's from, and the way street names work in Northern Ireland and commemoration. So I think I was often looking for links between stories that might help illustrate a point or a question that I was trying to answer. But yes, no, but I really do feel like I could write this whole book with the whole different stories because there's just so many. And people are interested in this stuff. I mean, academics have been writing about so much of these issues for so long, and I relied on so many of them and spoke to dozens and dozens of them. But of course, they're published in sort of minor geography journals, and don't really get the audience they deserve. So the one nice thing about this book was being able to bring so much of their research to life. Or to a broader public, really.
Can you speak to the social perception of a street address versus a P.O. box?
Oh, yes. Well, this is really interesting because in West Virginia, a lot of people had P.O. boxes and they really didn't want them because of the annoyance, right? You want to ship something that says no P.O. boxes. But this can play out in other ways. So there's a community, it's one of the richest communities in America. Is it Alpine, New Jersey? I don't know if it's still this way, but it was at the time I was researching it, that they only had, they did not have street addresses. So we have these very poor, this makes so much sense to me. We have these very, very poor parts of America that didn't have street addresses. And then you have these very rich parts of America, like Alpine, New Jersey, Carmel, California, who didn't have street addresses either. And in Alpine, New Jersey, yeah, you just got your mail to the post office. And I think the reason for them was that they liked the anonymity. There were a lot of celebrities and very rich people who lived there. And so they actually were fighting against street addresses because they wanted to be anonymous and to get their mail at the post office rather than to their door. I think Carmel actually, maybe you do actually get delivery to your door. I'm not sure if anybody knows that. But so you have this weird thing where in general, I think most people think of a P.O. box as slightly, so there maybe when I was growing up, there was maybe a slightly shady component to it, like, oh, you want to be anonymous with a P.O. box. I'd be curious to know whether that's still the case and people still get P.O. boxes as much as they did in the past. And certainly I know in some locations it's a necessity because you don't really get reliable mail to your house, or it's a status factor, perhaps, if you live in Alpine, New Jersey, not to have anybody know where you live. That's a really interesting question.
Living in a development where streets are labeled with Welsh or Irish nouns,
Yeah.
what is required to change a street name?
Oh, so what's required to change a street name? Is that the question? Yeah.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it varies so much. One nice thing about street addressing is that it's intensely local. There really isn't a lot of street naming on the national level. So these tend to be things that communities get involved in. And most of the communities that where this would come up, they would have some sort of ordinance or some sort of process for doing this, for changing a street name, a way that a citizen can say, for whatever reason, the street name does not suit. Sometimes the post office will get involved in the sense that you'll have two street names or 911 services. Like you have two street names that sound a lot alike. But they're spelled differently, and that's confusing for 911 or confusing for the post office. But often there is a way. Most of the street name changes that I came across were citizen started. The problem with it can be is that it can be quite expensive. So, for example, in the Hollywood, Florida case that I talked about in my in that was about changing Confederate street names, they had to have find somebody who was willing to donate the thousands of dollars that it was going to require to change the street names. I mean, presumably to change the street signs and the extra administrative work. And I'm not sure how that money is parsed down, but sometimes it turns out to be actually quite a hefty bill. But I imagine your community has some ordinance or process for doing this.
I was interested in the way Tokyo names the blocks instead of the streets, and how the street is negative space instead of the actual the thing that's paid attention to. What do you
Yes.
think that says about culture?
Yeah. I mean, I think I like about that chapter so much is that you just take for granted, you just don't know what you don't know, It never occurred to me until I started reading about Tokyo. So for those of you who haven't read the book, Tokyo has a really different way of addressing. So rather than addressing streets like the lines, they kind of address the block. And also, like, the numbers apparently, like, aren't in any particular order. Like, it's not, I mean, talk about, like, one up, like we were talking about. I think the street names are basically from when the houses were built. And famously in Tokyo, the life of a building is much shorter than in other parts of the world. So this happens a lot, that buildings are torn down and built and they'll get these new numbers. And I was so interested in this because it seemed a bit odd to me. Like, why wouldn't you do this? And the more I read people talking about it, the more I saw that the way I see the city as this Westerner is totally different. And and how much I was making assumptions about other parts of the world. And I talked to in that chapter, and I think he's an architect, Barry Shelton. Anyway, it's art. This I think he's an architect who had moved to Japan. His wife's Japanese, and he had made his theory about it is that streets are lines, right? Like, we have these lines, and English is written on lines. And so when we learn to write, we have this, like, lovely line paper. My kids still need it to write neatly, and we write on these lines. But in Japanese, things are written in squares. So the equivalent paper is, because they have these big characters, that its writing is in squares. And so his theory, and it's just a theory, but I think it's kind of a beautiful one, that our minds are trained to see space differently based on the way that we write. And so the way a Japanese person who grew up in Japan might experience a city is different from the way someone like me, who grew up in the US and English-speaking culture, might experience the city. I don't know if there are ways of actually proving this, but there is a lot of evidence that the way we see our lives and we organize ideas is related to the structure of our languages. So I was just really interested, and that was really, like, mind-blowing, tackling a lot of assumptions I had about how we see space.
As I was reading your excellent book, I was reminded of Foucault's critical theory about how systemic naming and categorization is a double-sided sword. It can give a sense of identity to people, providing the possibility of self-awareness, community, and political action. But it can also provide the state with an opportunity for surveillance and punishment.
Yes.
Does that ring true for you in terms of street naming and addressing the unaddressed?
Oh my gosh, I wish I could. That was so beautifully. I wish I could, like, copy and paste that and go back in time and put that right in the book, because I think you've totally nailed it. Like, that's why the book was actually quite fun to write. I really didn't want to write something that was, like, polemic, that this was how things should be and this is my opinion on these. I just like to expose the complexity of everything. And I think that comment really, or the question really, brings that out, right? Like, it's not neutral. It's just not neutral. Like, I just want to people to think about them. There are these aspects of addressing that are great, as you said, like with identity and packaging and mail. And then there are the things that are not that great, right? For example, something I read, it was just that, you can use them to track dissidents, for example. Tracking people is not always good for the state to be able to track people. Like I said, it really depends on your view of the state, how you see the state's ability to find you so quickly. But there is something deep that's wrapped up in identity and addresses, literal identity, for example. So, what's the last time you opened a bank account without a street address? Like, it's almost impossible. Like, we're constantly having to do address verification and things like that. And why is that? It's not so that the bank manager can come to your door. It's because you are connected with that address, and that's how they say you are who you are. But there's also this other flip side identity part of it, of that, yeah, it does become part of your identity, where you live and what your street name is. And, especially if you have any connection to the street name, this is also kind of powerful. So yeah, I think you said it much better than I did in the book.
Thank you for your comments on the hippocampi as it relates to what happens now with GPS. Senior care centers depend on landmarking, with pictures on the wall, to find the way through hallways where GPS is of no use. Are cities intentionally landmarking as well as naming streets?
Oh my God, that's an amazing question. I have no idea. I wish they would. I mean, I think cities are getting a lot better at navigation for the ordinary person. I don't know what it's like in Iowa, but in London, for example, a very big city with lots and lots of tourists, they're really good at having now maps and signpost places. I mean, this has gotten even better over the last sort of 10 years that I've been living here. But intentionally landmarking is interesting, especially in places. So one thing I talk about in the book is about how much easier it is to navigate places that are imageable. And that basically means places that have lots of landmarks to them. Whereas places that aren't imageable, say a place where everything is a certain kind of field, for example, or so a lot of rural communities cannot seem quite as imageable. There's not much, not much to see. Certain cities are less imageable than others just because there's fewer distinctive buildings. These places really are harder to navigate than other places. London's quite good because it's a big city. There's lots of statues and monuments and things like that. I think it's better than my own hometown in that sense. I did not realize that about care homes and that they may use the landmark. It sounds brilliant to me. It does seem like some of the apps are getting better. So, Google Maps now can let you look around at landmarks in order to find out to orient yourself where you are. At least you can on the map service here in the UK. But I have to say, for somebody who wrote a book on addresses, my navigational skills are very poor. So I am one who relies very, very strongly on landmarks myself. But that's a great question. It would be a great idea for a city planner to intentionally landmark, I think.
What do you want the ultimate takeaway for people reading your book to be?
Oh gosh. Oh, that's a great question. I think if people are just thinking about this at all, this is a success, right? I mean, if you're thinking about all of these things, and in general, I think you can do this with so many things in our lives. It's just something, and I think there's a lot of books written with this in mind. If you take something that's quite, you take something that's quite neutral, something like addresses where you don't really, how I was before I wrote this book, you don't really think about it, and you see all the complexity going on there. That addresses aren't neutral. The way you think about them and you taking them for granted and things like that it's important to think about these things. So I guess just in general, just pulling how much complexity you can pull out of something that we take for granted every day is probably what I would want people to get out of it. You don't necessarily, in my mind, have to have views one way or the other about all the issues that I talk about, but just the fact that you're thinking about them at all is to me a great success of the book.
If I heard this correctly, you
Yeah.
mentioned that you are now researching and writing about people's first
Yes.
names.
Yes.
What sparked your curiosity about that topic?
Oh, it's such a great topic. I guess it's something I've always been interested in. And obviously, looking back at this book, which is so much about names as well. But one of the things more specifically with this book was that the man that I quoted for the Karl Marx quote, he has a really unusual name. His name is, I'm going to pronounce it wrong. I think it's Mayoz, Maoz. I think it's Mayoz, but I'm not positive. And his last name's, I think, Azaryahu. Again, not positive on the pronunciation, but he has sort of an unusual name. And he said, how did you get into the, I have an unusual name. And you have an unusual name. Is this why we got into this? This was sort of the tenor of the conversation. Because I have a very unusual name. I'm unusually named after my mother, which is also very unusual. I'm black, but my name is funny enough, is sort of Irish derivation. It's very old fashioned in England and Ireland. But my husband is Irish. It sort of was that like a, there's some, but I have no other Irish connection. So I think I was always having these questions about it. So maybe that's sort of how I got into it. But there was also a lot of sort of similar themes from addresses that you can bring into people's names and also others as well.
When you find a topic which sparks your curiosity, what are your first steps in research or brainstorming which help you determine which ideas are fleeting fancies and which
Oh, that's a
ideas
good.
have legs?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I think I just start the way anybody starts, just with Google, just Googling Wikipedia, what's going on here? Like, what's happening here? What's interesting? And then I usually look to the academic research at that point. What are academics, really smart people who are writing for each other, not really for a general audience? What are they saying? So I tend to sort of, after I have a lay of the land, I tend to read as much as I can academically. I'm very lucky to be very close to the British Library, a little bit like the Library of Congress, in the sense that they have, just massive collection of academic books. And so I usually sort of dive into there. And then I interview a lot. So anytime I read an article that sort of I find really interesting, I email the professor who wrote it. And I say, can we have a conversation about this? I'm really interested. And you'd be surprised, even if they have no idea who you are, how many people who do this as their life's work want to tell people about it. So I get a pretty good strike rate of people who are willing to hop on a call, or if I happen to be in their city, talk to them. And often they have really interesting insights. The West Virginia article, for example, really came from an academic article. That was very academic, a really brilliant article. This a geographer who was very helpful in the book. His name's Reuben Rose Redwood, and he'd been talking to him. He had like all these other insights that didn't really fit in an academic world, and he was like, "Oh, you should, go out there, go to West Virginia, and see it for yourself." So that is basically how I do it. But as you say, there are a lot of rabbit holes that you go down. So for example, there was this story about Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, that I loved. I just thought it really fit in the book. And every time I would put it in the book, some editor or somebody would say, "This doesn't belong in this book." But I loved it. And I spent like, I probably 2 weeks just researching the story and how I was going to write the story. And then at the last minute, I thought, this story. In fact, how much time do you have? I'll tell you the story really quickly. So I get this story out. You guys will like this story. So you have Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He's living with his tutor, I believe. This is in, this is France. And he, And what happens is he's sitting there in the kitchen and he's studying. And the maid of the lady of the house, I believe, is drying some combs, some hair combs. And they're sitting there in the kitchen. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau is the only one in the kitchen at the time. But when the maid comes back, or when the lady of the house comes back, I can't remember, the comb is broken. And they say, "You did it." You tell Rousseau, "Of course you did it." And he's severely punished for this act. So what does this have to do with street addresses? This is what people always say. Here's why it's interesting. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, he claims he didn't do this. And he says that this was the point at which he grew up, because this was the point where he realized that people could not see what was in his soul, that he was not transparent. They could not see that he did not do it. They just saw the outside. And so he realized that they couldn't have this perfect communication, and that this was what, in some sense, what it meant to grow up. And I sort of saw this in the book a little bit as being about transparency. And there's a very famous academic, his name's Starobinsky, who writes about this in this way, about being able to see each other when we're addressing. But actually, I just really love the story, and I spent so long on it. Funny enough, my husband really thinks Rousseau did it. He really thinks he did it, and that he's lying. Whereas I like to believe that Rousseau was innocent of this crime. And so, though his feeling about everybody not seeing his true self is actually true. Anyway, so that's just one example of the sort of wormholes you can go into. And again, I talk to academics about this, but that don't end up making it. But I think enriched my life knowing that story.
Are there other innovations in addressing? You mentioned the one where everything is numbers, but are there other innovations that you discovered coming up?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's always something. There's so many startups now. I still get emails from them, who are finding new ways of addressing. So in the book, I talk about this one called What Three Words, which has divided all the world up into these small squares that are that they give the sign three random words to find your place. Google, has really gotten into the game in a big way. I think what's going to be really interesting to follow with addressing is that I've had a few calls with people in parts of the world that still don't have addresses, like, much of Africa, for example, or parts of the Middle East or other places that are looking for ways to harness the technology, because it's actually a huge barrier to development. So you have to be able to do shipping. You have to be able to do credit. You have to be able, logistics is just, I mean, this isn't my field at all, but it's just a huge aspect of commerce. It's just the logistics of getting things back and forth, or being able to deliver a pizza without 10 phone calls, which are actually quite expensive in all these different ways. So what I hear about more, and the more people I talk to, are really about what are the ways that we're going to find to not just tackle, like, wealthy areas that might want more specific addresses, or you take your Amazon package to the back door rather than the front door. Maybe you should have a different address or different code for your back door rather than your front door, and really still start to address these massive places that logistically need addresses. And it's really, really hard addressing from scratch. I mean, there are many countries who have tried and succeeded, and there are many countries who are trying and failing. It's, a friend of mine was talking about a friend he had who was a Syrian economist who thought he could boost the economy of Syria. This is before the war, just by, using a Sharpie pen. He just needed a Sharpie pen to write numbers on all the doors. It's not that easy. You'd think it would be that easy, but it really isn't. It's quite a science, and it's difficult to get all of the different people who need to work together to do it properly. And it's expensive to do so. So I think that the real innovations will be the people and company and governments who are tackling that problem.
What was most surprising to you as you wrote the book?
Oh, what was most surprising? Oh gosh, that's a great question. Yeah, I talked about the Japan stuff, which sort of blew my mind. Yeah, I think actually, I think what it was is almost like what I just said. I think I'll go back to the start. I still say the most surprising thing to me is that millions of people, maybe a billion people, don't have street addresses. I think that still kind of blows my mind a bit, that there's still so much of the world in this modern age with commerce and logistics and just money, just everything, that so many places in the world are unaddressed or basically unmapped. We sort of think of every part of the world being sort of covered by the all-seeing eye of technology. And the more you read about this and you talk to people who are working in places all over the world, it's not. And it's surprising to me that we haven't really yet solved that problem. I think, yeah, so I would still say what started me on the book is probably still what shocks me the most.
And what is your next project, and/or where else can we read your work?
That's so nice. My next project is, as I said, I've just started on this new book, which is about people's names. So again, it's a bit like this book in a way. So I'm going to France next week to interview loads of people about different aspects of and controversies in France over naming. The chapter that I've recently written is on Iceland, which has a closed list of names that's tied to sort of Icelandic nationalism. So yeah, so that's sort of my next project. So that's pretty much what I'm working on. But I often do sometimes publish things in, newspapers or like, I read books for the New York Times sometimes, or I have old articles. I have actually have a very funny article about, I think it's funny. I'm allowed to say that. That's about NPR reporters' names that I wrote some time ago, but I still think it's one of my favorite things I've written, which is about why, when you listen to NPR, if you do listen to NPR, the names really stick in your mind, like, Sylvia Poggioli, and why, why all these names become important to us. And I interviewed a lot of NPR reporters about their names, and so that's fun. But in general, right now, I'm sort of back to book writing mode. But thank you. But thank you for your interest.
We have about 7 more minutes if
Yeah.
anyone has another question. There aren't any open questions at the moment. I was struck by how recent zip codes were. That was
Oh,
very
I know.
surprising to me.
It's totally recent, and we suddenly take them for granted, and they're so useful. I mean, what's another interesting zip code story is actually Ireland. So Ireland never had zip codes until, like, oh my, is it even 5 years ago? Maybe 10 years ago, less, I'd say. And people really didn't want them. They were like, Ireland, everybody knows everybody. This is what everybody knows everybody else here. We're such a small country, and everything like that. They love them. Now they have them, they love them. And so now I realize because they're super convenient. And it's interesting the way zip codes work in different countries. So, where I'm from in North Carolina, that covers quite a big part of my town, my zip code. In England, it's very small. Your postcode probably covers, my postcode probably covers 40 houses or something. It's not big space. They're sort of very, very local, your postcodes. And in Ireland, I believe it's even more so. It's like quite specific to your house. So it actually is very easy for a delivery driver, for example, to find you on your postcode. So I always think Ireland's really interesting because they're sort of like those Viennese who said, we don't want these street num we don't want these house numbers. And then suddenly they were using them, like almost instantly, they used them for everything. So in Vienna, for example, right after that, very soon after they got house numbers, there were like lost dog signs, which I thought was lovely, listing, if you find this dog, take them to house number 12 or whatever on the street. One of the facts that always sticks out is that Mozart lived in 12 different addresses in Vienna. Like, he was constantly moving, constantly changing addresses. So it's funny how very quickly people forgot that they at first thought this was like the state trying to reach in and take their freedom. And soon we all discover this. And it was interesting because the book came out in April of 2020. So obviously at the very start of the pandemic. And I felt like we were all very interested in our addresses at that point, right? Because we were all getting deliveries and we were all staying in. And also, a lot of the public health mapping was done with things like zip codes, where certain zip codes were, at higher alert than others. And a lot of the public health mapping actually was quite place-based. So in some sense, the book came out at a timely time in terms of us thinking about space or where we weren't going, really, I suppose.
Are there many cases where official names of streets are ignored? For example, Sixth Avenue in New York City is called Avenue of the Americas.
Yes, that was one of the stories that was left out, and that was about how Avenue of the Americas became Avenue of the Americas, and was this really big deal, and then nobody ever used it. Absolutely, and there are places. There's a bit of the book I really like. I can't remember which. I guess maybe it's in the New York chapter that talks about how certain communities have renamed streets, right? And so it talks about how in Chinatown in New York, of a lot of the people who live there do not use the street names that are there, and they rename them based on what happens there, you know. So they have their own map of street names, and the same was true in San Francisco, that the local community, the names do not match up with the official. I think I say, you know, the name doesn't have to match the birth certificate, right? So the way people talk about space and their names were based on or based on older names. And this still happens in places where the street name changes. In my own hometown, there was a street that I always grew up knowing as Airport Road, and it was actually changed to Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, I guess, after I moved, and which was, you know, right by me. But at the same time, in my head, it was always going to be the Airport Road. It was Airport Road. It led to the airport. There was an old airport there. It led to the airport. It was Airport Road. Now I go home and I have no problem saying MLK Boulevard. I forget it was even Airport Road. It's amazing how much these things come to me. But for a very long time, you know, for an outsider, I'm sure most people were calling it Airport Road, or they were trying to figure out why. But we do tend to come around in the end.
It's funny how you said, made that point about insiders and outsiders, because I was thinking of Chicago and how they nicknamed the freeways. And, you know, the residents know what the Dan Ryan is, but if you're an outsider, you're going, okay, what number?
Yes. I think that's so true of so many places. I mean, that's interesting that it's in Chicago in a big city, because I definitely found that. That's a really great fact, actually. I definitely found that in West Virginia, because there was one point, which I'm trying to find someone in the book for those of you who read it, and I'm asking this man who's sitting in his truck on the side of the road for directions, and he's like, oh, he's a big person of the town. He was the pastor. He's like, well, do you know where my house is? I mean, that genuinely. And I said, well, no, but people in the community would know. He probably lived in some, you know, he was trying to orient me in some way, but everything he was orienting around were things you would have to know. And one example from that was that there's one very small community. When I say small, these communities are like 100 people or less, some of them. And they would navigate around the name of a school that had burned down like 20 years before. So it literally was that you could not find your way around without knowing some of the history, which is problematic, but also kind of beautiful. Like, I kind of thought that the way that history was woven into the way people had directions and they saw their space was totally different from the way my experience of growing up in my own hometown was. Like, you know, in the sense that you really have to know the landscapes and what they mean and the landmarks. So I think there's also is some beauty in being able to see where you live in that way.
Well, thank you very much. This has been just
Oh,
so very
awesome. Thank you for
interesting.
having me. I'll take any excuse to talk about street addresses with people who are equally interested. So thank you for all the excellent questions.
Well, and thank you everyone for coming. Enjoy the rest of your day.